Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 178. I'm Rob Wright, Security News Director at TechTarget, and I am here, as usual, with Alex Kalafi, Security News Writer. Alex, welcome.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here, as always.
I know. It's a quiet Wednesday. We're recording this on July 21st. Quiet Wednesday, not as much going on in the security, cybersecurity, InfoSec news world right now. So I thought it was a good opportunity to discuss the patching problem. This is something, Alex, that you wrote about recently for Search Security. You wrote a very long, in-depth article about why organizations still aren't patching a very basic, like basic problem, basic question. Why isn't time to patching or time to patch better, the average time to patch? Why are so many organizations failing to patch critical and high profile vulnerabilities years after the fact, even though they're under attack? What's going on here? And you really dug into it. I think initially I think we wanted both to sort of find out more about who these organizations are. But we learned that that's not an easy question to answer, for a variety of reasons, but let's get into the story. So what, if there's one thing that you, I guess one takeaway from the article right off the bat, what would you go with here? As someone is who is immersed in this stuff for months, talking to a number of different experts, vendors, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So to back up a little bit, I guess sort of the motivation of writing this story was like I did the dark web story a few months ago, and I did the Oldsmar critical infrastructure. I think sometimes, like, because I'm still, like, in the grand scheme of things, new to this beat, I'll sometimes ask myself, like, what is this thing? What actually is the dark web or this cyber Pearl Harbor thing? Why hasn't it happened, or has it happened and I just didn't notice? And then this one was, why are there still new exploits for vulnerabilities that were patched 3 years ago? Which, if you're listening to this and you're a dedicated security professional, you may think it's a naive question. And of course it is. But that question did motivate this article, and it was me trying to figure out, like, to answer the question for myself and hopefully other folks, why is patching a problem? And I think there's a lot of reasons, but if I had to put one primary reason, I think resources are the one sort of at the top, you know, whether it's people aren't putting money that they don't have into security, or they're not using the money correctly, which I don't mean to talk down to someone. I'm no security expert, but it seems like that's sort of the general tone, like priorities and whatnot. Or you do have the money, but you're not taking security seriously because you haven't gotten hit by an attack and you don't think it's something you need to get dedicated a ton of time into.
Complacency. But,
exactly. So whether it's allocation or a lack of resources, the big takeaway was, why are there people who don't patch? Because of resources. Multiple folks said that, like, once you get below the Fortune and Forbes 500, 2000, it's a tough time to necessarily always have the resources to carry the security posture you need.
Yep. And even when you are at that level, or you're a major enterprise that, you know, has 1,000+ employees and millions or billions in revenue, it's still not easy. And those organizations do run into their fair share of patching issues, and we'll get into that a little later. But I think the thing that, you know, we talked about this early on with you, with your work on the article. And I tried to provide a little context or a little background for this. And I don't think your question was naive at all, because if I was coming into this and, you know, I was seeing some of the numbers, I'd say I'd have the same reaction. How are there nearly 100,000 Microsoft customers or Microsoft Exchange servers that have not been patched for proxy logon and the other three 0 days? Like you have a perfect storm going on right there. You have nation state threat actors. You have mass exploitation of these vulnerabilities. 0 days all over the news. Advisory after advisory from Microsoft, CISA, FBI, name your vendor, name your agency, all over the place. And what were some of the numbers for proxy? I think it was like 800,000 in the first 10 days.
So it was, well, it was about
85,000. Sorry.
Right. So it was about 400,000 servers were vulnerable when the patch was released as mm-hmm. far. I think that's what it was. And then 10 days later, it was about, it was 82,000 on March 11th.
Right.
By late April, it was 18,000, which is when I originally talked to Risk IQ, who recently entered an agreement to be acquired by Microsoft.
Yes.
And they were tracking the number of servers and whatnot that were still vulnerable in partnership. Anyways, on June 21st, when I contacted them again to get something more updated, it was 15,000. So 15,000 servers still vulnerable to proxy logon. Now,
that's still a lot.
The explanation that I got was that a certain percentage of them were honeypots.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And some of them, they may have been inactive, and that it was a sort of tiny share of the overall number of servers out there. But yep. 5 digits still seems like a lot, even with that stuff factored in, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not saying they're wrong. Obviously, no, they no, know no, more no, than no, I do.
No, but, I think they're right. I think you're talking about a number of honeypots. You're talking about a number of quote unquote decommissioned or unused servers that for whatever reason weren't completely decommissioned. But then you're also right. talking about a percentage in there of people that are of organizations that are still using that software. And, you know, maybe it's pirated software. Maybe it's just smaller and medium businesses that are just in the dark about this stuff and don't know what they're doing and don't know how to pat. It's you don't have 15,000 honeypots. I'm pretty sure of that. And that's still, I think you're right. I think you're talking about 15,000. That's still not an insignificant number.
Cause these aren't individual people like you or me.
No,
these are, it could be small businesses, but it's organizations on various levels.
Sure. This isn't, you're not talking about home routers and you know, a small business or home office, you know, software. We're talking about, I mean, Exchange Server, like this is what businesses use for email. I think the thing, circling back to sort of the background I have on this, 10 years ago, there would have been a number of people, analysts, experts, InfoSec researchers, threat researchers, vendor executives, who would have told you, the patching situation isn't great right now, but it's, you know, it's going to get better. Like patching rates and time to patch and all that stuff is going to improve. For a number of reasons, not the least of which is because, you know, another decade of companies sort of maturing their enterprise security programs would help that effort. Just general awareness about critical vulnerabilities and exploitation and nation state attacks and all the stuff, all this urgent stuff that is happening lately. Everybody feels like their hair is on fire. And also like things, other factors as well, which I'm sure we'll touch on later, but all of that was going to contribute to sort of an improvement and that mm-hmm. we were going to be in a better spot. And maybe we are, and it just doesn't feel like it, but it's still a huge, huge problem. You read about the number of major products that have a critical vulnerability. Like the VPNs is just shocking. I mean, how many times do we see like a CISA alert or an FBI alert or some vendor alert, basically saying this VPN or this network security appliance, the vulnerability is from 2019.
Yep, and it's Fortinet, FortiGate.
And it's under attack again. And
that was the other thing. It wasn't just proxy. This isn't a proxy logon story either.
No,
I saw the Fortinet thing and I'm like, it's been 2 years, which isn't when you have that flabbergasted, you're saying it from a point of knowledge. I'm saying it from a, I don't get it kind of thing.
I mean, it's, you wonder what's happening here and how much, you mentioned resources and employees and products and stuff like that. But I think, the problems that we're running into aren't all just a matter of, well, the client or the customer needs to do better. I definitely think there's some of that. I mean, our colleague, Sean Nichols, we've talked about this with him, about how, especially with server software, it's hard, the Apache server software, it's hard to schedule downtime to apply a major, a major fix that's going to knock your website or your infrastructure offline, or just scheduling the downtime, even if it's just a quick, shutdown and restart. It's not easy. It's not an easy sell. On the other hand, like, it does feel like the vendors themselves could be doing a little bit better job. And I think some of them are trying to do that. You've touched on that in the article about, hey, we want to do more outreach, regular Patch Tuesdays, like Microsoft and Adobe and other vendors have, but especially like, what was the machine readable advisories?
Yeah. Cisco, Omar Santos, who, he's like a chair of a committee,
right,
that's dedicated to that in a large part, and machine readable advisories. And I'd say, like, when you got to the bigger vendors, definitely, whether it was a pitch or what they actually thought, because the point is still valid. Yeah. There's a big focus on automation, automation, orchestration, just making it so it was more set it and forget it. And if not that, using cloud-based software like SaaS type situations in order to not, like, it's not set it and forget it, but to make it closer to set it and forget it, so you can not have to dedicate as many resources to that. Although that's even easier said than done, because automation, because I was doing my own research on that, that, yeah, can be very expensive even if applied quote unquote correctly, but like, it can be expensive depending on the organization and the needs. Probably not more expensive than the human bodies it would take to have a full security thing, but expensive. So,
yeah. The organization, by the way, that Santos is the chair of is the OASIS Common Security Advisory, yep, Framework Technical Committee. That's a mouthful. But basically, yeah, machine readable advisories. You send the advisories out, they are received by whatever vulnerability management system or automated sort of intake you have for vulnerability alerts or security alerts or advisories. That is, it's analyzed and it's prioritized and it's, but you still need, you still need people to, make sure to test the patch, to make sure the patch is applied, to do all that. As much as I would love for automation, automated vulnerability management to be a thing that everybody can use, like you said, it's expensive. In a perfect world, and I know the article touched on this too, you would have everybody sort of, falling in line with, or for the most part, automatic updates, save a few things here and there. But like, I know most organizations don't have automatic updates for Windows,
mm-hmm,
for their endpoints, even, to say nothing of their infrastructure and their software. I mean, it would be nice if they did, but they don't. And when you leave it up to the organization, you have to make sure that you have the people, at least one person who's in charge of that type of thing. And to your point, I think a lot don't. And whenever we get into like the patching problem, you know, what are the, who are these 15,000? Who are these 84,000? Who are these 400,000, you know, that haven't patched these flaws, whatever the number is for this enterprise software? I think privately, a lot of times what you'll hear from people on the, you know, the security research side, threat research, whatever, they'll kind of say, well, it's probably a lot of smaller business. It's probably a lot of SMBs. It's probably a lot of folks that have a network admin and that's it. And these things just pile up and they can't prioritize. And there's just, you know, we threw that metric about the number of vulnerabilities, the number of CVEs that we've had, you know, last year compared to 10 years ago is twice as many. You know, the number just keeps going up. It's hard to keep up with these things. But they kind of, you know, in their heads and in privately, they just, a lot of them will just say, well, it's SMBs. And they, and you know, if they don't have a managed service provider to help them apply patches and so on and so forth, that's bad.
You mentioned the sort of the fact that not everyone offers automatic updates.
Yeah.
And I mentioned the resources thing at the beginning, but I think that scratches the surface of the difficulties that a lot of smaller businesses deal with, according to the people I talked to. And I tried to write the article from an empathetic place. There was no finger wagging at anyone.
Right, you did. Yeah,
beyond like a tiny bit here and there from the people who are quoted. Right? Okay. So there's no Patch Tuesday is not a consistent thing across the industry or something like Patch Tuesday. And not always automatic updates, and patches aren't always communicated in the same way. Sometimes there's a newsletter, maybe machine readable. Sometimes you have to go to the website.
Yep.
And that's just why it's difficult to get the patches that exist. Then it goes to how many things you need to keep on top of. And to do that, I want to share one of my favorite moments from all the interviews doing this. It was Mandy and Senior Director of Advanced Practices, Steve Stone, who his interview was awesome because he was just basically telling me, like, I was like, what is the patching problem? And he might have been like my first interview. So I was like, what is the patching problem? Why don't people patch? And he's like, I can't give you a perspective on what the world looks like. He wasn't avoiding as much as he was trying to explain how messy the patching problem was.
Yes.
And the best way he sort of illustrated this was, he's like, you got a cell phone? Yeah. Different vendors and softwares do you have in your own personal cell phone right now? And I'm like, God, it must be dozens, if not hundreds. And he's like, now stretch that to an organizational scale.
Yeah.
Which was, I would say, a very nice point. So that's they don't have enough resources because in part it takes a lot of resources.
Yep.
To sort of manage this stuff, especially if you don't have a complete inventory on everything you have. And McAfee, Steve Grobman told me a couple months ago that it was at RSA. He was saying that, like, not everything is centralized. Like, you might have different departments handling different technology, and not everyone talks to each other. And then you also got technical debt going on.
Right.
So as I think we're starting to sort of portray for the listeners, there's this tangled mess of computer cords that you have to deal with before you even answer why people don't patch.
Yeah. And you brought up a great point from the quote from Stone. The fact of the matter is, going back to the start of the conversation, you know, trying to figure out who the unpatched are, these vendors, even the biggest vendors, even some of the best vendors, the guys that really know this stuff and really know, you know, but the value of patches and the need to urgently patch when there's a critical vulnerability under exploitation, the most resourceful vendors, the largest vendors with the most money, whether it's Microsoft or whoever, the fact of the matter is they, their visibility into their customer base is extremely limited. When you have a number of businesses, organizations, government agencies, nonprofits, US, outside the US, different regions, different localities, it's hard to get the word to them sometimes and to figure out if those organizations have acted on that advisory, if they have implemented the patch. It's and then to find out who they are. I mean, this absolutely blows my mind. But with the proxy logon situation, if you remember this, there were still, you know, because there were so many thousands, tens of thousands of servers that were vulnerable to these attacks. And it wasn't just the Hafnium, you know, Chinese nation state threat actors that were exploiting it. Cyber criminals were jumping on it. You had potential ransomware attacks. And Microsoft and the FBI were like, hey, we're trying to get in touch with them. Remember, the FBI like accessed some of these servers.
Mm-hmm.
And they waltzed in and they started removing web shells. They could do that, but in a lot of cases, they still couldn't. They couldn't get a live body or an email address on the other end of that server to figure out who was the point of contact. Who do we tell that we're doing this? Who do we tell, you know, hey, you need to patch. This is urgent. They had to go to ISPs and domain registrars. I mean, that is absurd. I mean, this is the type of stuff, Alex, I'll just tell you, this is the type of stuff that happened like 20 years ago. You know, when, you know, not every organization, the cybersecurity picture in terms of threats was vastly different. And you would have Microsoft or Cisco or whoever say like, oh, we're updating our OS and we're doing this. And we think there might be a serious security threat and we're trying to get in touch with all of our customers. So we're going through, I mean, literally like going through the phone book, trying to get these people, you know, email them and call them or whatever. And like that just goes to show you that it's really hard, that just because somebody pays for your product doesn't mean you have a direct line to them or insight into how they operate or contact information for something as basic as just calling this company up or business or nonprofit or whoever and say, hey, you guys are under attack. You've got malicious web shells in your environment. You need to patch your servers now. The fact that we're still at that point is kind of amazing to me. And what's more is I think that in addition to what you said about, hey, automation is gonna help address this issue. I agree. But I also wonder if like, I don't know, do we need a better outreach mechanism? Because there's the case with, you know, the Acelion breach. I think it was the Royal Bank of New Zealand that put Acelion mm-hmm. on blast, and they called up. I don't remember if it was Deloitte or it was another Accenture or another firm, but they had one of the big consulting firms come in and start investigating like why they didn't get a notification about the 0 day, the Acelion FTA. Vulnerability and why they didn't know about it and why they didn't get any notification about the patch. And hey, we would have patched, but we didn't hear about it until January and we were attacked in December or whatever. It's KPMG International. Apologies to KPMG. I almost got it. But, you know, just sending an email to someone is not going to get it done. And I know that we don't have phone numbers for all of these customers and all of these people. But, you know, in application notifications, like when you fire up that application or you open that application dashboard or whatever,
mm-hmm.
having some mechanism in there that just says in flashing red lights, like red alert, you need to patch this now. there's a vulnerability, it's critical, or there's a critical vulnerability and it's under exploitation. Like, I think we could be doing a better job of on the vendor side of the notification. But I another thing that came up in your article, like you said, switching to SaaS was switching to cloud, like exclusively cloud. If I was a small and medium business, I mean, if you were a small and medium business right now and you were starting up, would you buy any on-premise software knowing what you know now?
God, I'm not educated enough to answer that question, Rob. What would you do?
I would. I mean, I know SaaS can sometimes be as big of a pain as on-premise software, and you have less control, and you're not housing the data, and there's all sorts of considerations that go into it. But if I was a company, if I was a startup that was really concerned about my potential inability to patch and maintain applications and update them, yeah, I would try to use as many cloud apps as I could, and as much cloud services and cloud resources, so I didn't have to worry about, you know, I don't want to worry about like an Apache Struts vulnerability. I might not even know that I have Apache Struts in the equipment that I bought. You know, how many open source bits of software have been cobbled together and thrown into some commercial products out there? And like, there may be a protocol or some piece or something somewhere that isn't being maintained to the best of its ability or to the best of the organization's ability. And you've got to drop everything and patch. How are you even going to know if that's in your environment if you're not doing proper asset inventory and you don't have full visibility into what you're using? It's just really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Talking about a couple, you were talking about solutions, quote,
yes,
whatever you would say, quotes on solutions, but I'd say the things that an organization can do today. Some of the stuff was, again, prioritize you going SaaS or automation.
Yep.
Doing an inventory.
Yes.
To make sure you know what you have. Eliminate technical debt, which is, again, easier said than done. And then one of the other interesting ones was information sharing between organizations to improve cybersecurity on both an individual and industry level. In general, just talk to your peers, even if you're competitors. You having better security and them having better security is better for everyone, was kind of the tone of that. And then vendors, direct outreach was helpful in the case of RiskIQ, who did contact ISPs but did have a good rate.
I'll circle back to that point.
Building an automation. And then I also want to talk about another one of my sources, Jake Koons of Risk-Based Security, a vulnerability intelligence firm. He was kind of the Wild West cowboy of my interview subjects, which is great, because I think it was nice to have a Wild West cowboy kind of guy. But he was straight up saying, like, exactly what you were saying. This is basically unchanged from where the vulnerability patching problem was 10 years ago. And we should talk again in 2031.
Oh, God.
Because it might not be any better, is kind of the thing. And he was saying, like, you know what companies should do? They should make buying decisions based on who's making good software.
For sure.
Like, who's, if people are releasing busted software, don't buy it, is kind of his.
Yep.
Now, granted, risk-based security actually does play in the space of making those recommendations.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's also a valid point. And when I was sort of piecing this together, the Legos of the story, trying to figure out like what would go in each section.
Right.
As for how vendors can improve the patching problem, he was just straight up saying, like, there are types of vulnerabilities like SQL injections that should not be happening anymore. Or and they still happen all the time, which,
and we've seen a few of them.
SQL injection was Kaseya.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm just, it's there were some interesting, there were some interesting responses, but inventory, maybe looking into automation where you can, good security hygiene.
Yeah. The basics.
And I guess to go back to something Graben was saying, take cybersecurity seriously, I guess, if you're not yet. Although if you're listening to this show, I'm not really helping anyone by saying this, because if you're listening, you're probably already
fingers crossed,
way more knowledgeable than me or taking it seriously. But his sort of point was, because the house hasn't burned down yet, he thinks it's fine to spray an aerosol can at an open flame on the stove, which wasn't, that wasn't his exact picture he was painting,
right,
but that was kind of the point.
Yeah, I think Jake is correct in that in a perfect world, it'd be nice for organizations to do more of their purchasing based on security track records and vulnerability, and what kind of vulnerabilities is this software company patching? Like if it's SQL injection, or if it's, you know, really, you know, cross-site scripting. It's just like, there's some stuff that you should rule out pretty much right off the bat before you release products. And, you know, we're slowly getting there. I mean, there's the DevSecOps movement. There's much more care in terms of some of the newer software, what type of code they're releasing and how they're releasing and what type of review it goes through before it lands in customer environments. But he's right. I mean, this should not be happening. I want to circle back. I think after reading your story and after seeing what's been going on lately, I think direct outreach is, I don't know that it's feasible, but it seems like it really works. Like everyone, whether it's Risk IQ or other organizations, like when they say, or MSPs, like when MSPs say, oh, you know, we let our customer know you've got a vulnerability that's critical, that you need to patch this right away. That like, they're much more likely to act on it than if you just send an email or an advisory or Slack them, or just have non sort of direct interpersonal communications with them. And I don't know whether it's shaming people. I don't know whether it's just the difference in talking to a live person or is it puts more pressure on. I don't know. I don't know what the psychology of the situation is, but I do think it works. But I wonder, I mean, you can't have, like, Kaseya can't call 300, you know, or 35,000 of its customers, of its VSA customers, telling them that they got a patch. This is just not feasible. Like you can't have like a call center with all they're doing is looking up numbers and checking, you know, domain registration records and calling ISPs and trying to play, you know, sleuth here to track these companies down and then get somebody live on the phone and talk them into patching. That said, it would be nice, and you know, in my dream of dreams, there was like an agency or a nonprofit or some type of consortium where that's part of what they did, or all they did was just when something hits and you know there's going to be 100,000 or 50,000 or even 15,000 environments out there that are not applying the patch and they are vulnerable, just rolling these people out, and all they do is try to hunt these folks down and call them and get them on the phone to respond, you know, direct outreach, direct pleas to these organizations. Again, I don't think it's feasible to have something like that. I definitely don't think it's feasible for a vendor to do it, but alone, that is. But I think it works. Like you said, that's something that Risk IQ is something that other organizations, other vendors have done recently. And it seems like it's had at least some improvement on the numbers. So, but we'll see. Maybe, Alex, maybe I'm overthinking this. You and I, a little startup of our own, we could have a little side hustle where we, this is like our thing. This is our, we'll launch our own company. No one would invest in it, but it'd be a nice idea. You know,
yeah.
You and I could go into business together. We could be like the patch your stuff now, guys.
An indie security firm.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure people would be thrilled.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that kind of sort of covers it. Hopefully, over time, the patching problem can be defeated by 1,000 paper cuts. But I think that's what it's going to take.
I think you're right.
In the meantime.
Yeah, and we're going to be revisiting this. You know, we always have a few stories about, you know, lackluster patching rates and so on and so forth. We're going to continue to look into this and see if we can gain more insight, especially into the customer end of this. But I highly encourage everybody to read Alex's story. It's really insightful. It's got a lot of good commentary from a lot of important, really intelligent people. So good work on that.
Thanks, Rob.
And thank you, Alex, for talking about it here on the podcast. This was I think we had a spirited discussion. I don't know if our startup idea is going to take off, but you know, never say never.
I'll have names by next episode.
Excellent. Excellent. And thank you to the readers and listeners of Search Security. I'm Rob Wright, and we'll see you next time.